Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host.
Today, I'm speaking with David Lockington, a consultant ophthalmologist from Glasgow and one of the newly appointed simulation leads at the college. I'm also joined by Jennifer Hind, an ST7 trainee and trainee simulation lead from the West of Scotland. Thank you both so much for joining me today to talk about the future of simulation. Now, my first question is for you, Jennifer. Simulation has changed so much in recent years, and I was wondering, in your 7 years as a trainee, what's the biggest change that you've noticed?
I think for me, it is potentially the increasing importance of simulation. So I was lucky at the beginning of my training, we had access to the IC simulator, and I certainly found it very useful. And that's one of the things that brought me and developed my interest in simulation. So I was very aware that if I'd been using the simulator, I was much more confident and much more capable in theatre, and I was able to get much more out of each individual theatre session. We then in the West of Scotland developed the simulation suite, and we now have a lot more in the way of equipment. So we took what was the IC, which is able to simulate cataract surgery, and we're now able to simulate a whole host of other things, laser procedures. The one thing that IC doesn't do, so corneal incisions and suturing, so we can do that, and a variety of other sort of subspecialist procedures. So I think it's increasing importance, but also increasing availability of equipment.
And, you know, your article in iNews demonstrated how you've set up your whole new brand new dry lab setup, which it looks fantastic. But do you think one of the issues that we've got across the country is a real discrepancy in terms of the availability of such resources for trainees?
I mean, I'm personally aware of the equipment that we have and various other colleagues across Scotland, and I know there's certainly good access to kind of IC simulation. For the rest of it, I think because a lot of it is quite low technology, it is quite easy to develop access to these things. So hopefully with time and with increasing pressure from both the college and from trainees, we can develop greater access for everybody.
So Jennifer, you know, your article in iNews was really interesting, where you described how you set up the dry lab in Glasgow. But, you know, for those listeners who haven't actually read that article, and say we've got a trainee who actually really wants to set up their own dry lab and get that simulation experience in their own local hospital, what would you say to them?
I think the first thing is about identifying resources and identifying a need. We developed the dry lab for the whole West of Scotland deanery in the sort of main central hospital where a lot of us work, and also where the trainees usually are every week for postgraduate teaching. So I think you have to choose your location. I think the other thing that it's important to do is to be aware of what is already existing and to work with the trainee body. So this was something that we found was very important, that it wasn't just myself and David powering this through. This is something that the trainees were all engaged with and they all wanted. And then I think we kind of developed the project from there.
So a question for both of you really is, you know, now that you've got this dry lab set up, how has the trainee uptake been?
I think the trainee uptake has been excellent. So it has slightly coincided with, over the last year, the lockdown and the cancellation of a lot of elective surgery. And we've certainly found in the West of Scotland that the use of the simulation suite and the IC simulator has gone up considerably. And some of that is to do with lack of actual operating for trainees. But I think having this resource, trainees feel that simulation is something that is valued and something that is important and also something that is essential. And so this is something that I think everybody has been engaging with a lot more. I do think that our work with simulation has probably just really started, because now that we've got this suite, we need to make sure that we use it and maximise, get the most out of it effectively that we can.
Perhaps this is more of a question for David rather than yourself, Jennifer, but you know, now that you've raised the funds to set up this dry lab, which seemed like quite a large sum of money, it's not just the money that's required to set this up though, is it? It's the future ongoing costs, so consumables, sutures, intraocular lenses, model eyes, and other equipment. You know, how do you go about the funding for this? Does the trainee have to foot the bill themselves and buy their own model eyes, or is that something that the hospital provides each trainee?
So cost is going to be a real issue with simulation, but we need to consider what is simulation in the first instance. And to me, simulation is learning how to do surgical skills competently before you do them on a patient with confidence. So it takes the patient out of the equation. And so if we're going to talk about cost, we need to understand the costs of not participating in simulation and the costs of a complication and the costs of follow-up. And some of those costs will be borne by the patient, worst of all, but also by the trainees. Trainees don't want to be put in a position where they don't know what they're doing, made to feel vulnerable, and then suffer, regardless of potential complaints and potential court cases. So it's in everybody's interest to get it right first time. So we were very fortunate in Glasgow to have a generous endowment fund, which helped stump up the money for setup. And a significant amount of that money was to do with building infrastructure. So it shouldn't be the case in other locations that it is as expensive. But you're absolutely right. How do you sustain the simulation facility? And we have tried to develop a one-eye multiple procedure concept by encouraging the trainees to use the model eyes frequently. So for example, you can do a keratome incision on a model eye and stitch it up, and you can probably fit about 15 keratome incisions all the way around that eye, suture and remove, suture and remove. You can do traumatic repairs, you can practice your capsulorhexis, and you can continually do this. So you can make use of the resource more than once. We need to get away from this use once and throw away mentality and show each other how we can make best use to keep the skills up and the costs down.
That sounds great. You've just been appointed as one of the new simulation leads at the college. And what would you say your main goals are for the next period or the time that you'll be going to be in office?
So yeah, it's a big honour to take on this role. And I'd like to acknowledge the work of Arijit Mitra, who was the first simulation lead and has really set a lot of these things up. I view myself as really a cheerleader to try to show good practice and encourage others to do the same. We need to ensure people are engaged with simulation, but we also need to empower them to make use of the situation they're in. As Jennifer's described, once we got our circumstances sorted out, it encouraged everybody in our department to engage with it a lot more and to teach. And then by providing the resources, we were able to get the senior trainees to teach the junior trainees and then the subspecialty consultants to teach the senior trainees particular techniques. And I would bring Jennifer back in because one of her great strengths is encouraging the trainees together. And we've done a number of ICY projects, but also she ran one of our laser simulation days, which was incredibly well received. But again, you've got to ask, why has it taken so long for us to do that? Some of it has been to do with the lack of resources, but also across the board as a national simulation lead, I want to encourage people to change the culture. We need to have a patient safety first mentality, and simulation will fill that gap.
One of the things you were talking about was laser simulation, and we know really well from surveys, data, etc., that especially junior trainees, you know, trainees report a lack of confidence in performing laser procedures, for example, YAG laser PIs. How do you simulate for these procedures?
Well, this is something that's quite interesting. So I think the confidence issue is a lot of the time, if you're doing something infrequently, you're not able to develop the skills and be good at something because you're not doing it regularly. And I think simulation can help with that. Now, the college website has some resources for where you can purchase some of the equipment, and we personally found that the YAG laser simulation eyes, which you can purchase from I think the company is Insight, it's in the States, so they are designed for simulation for YAG laser PIs and YAG capsulotomies, and they're very good. And so what we had was we purchased a sort of set of these eyes, both the capsulotomy and the PI eyes. We did a teaching session for small groups of trainees, so there was a brief presentation on how to do a capsulotomy and how to do the iridotomies. And then we took the trainees up to the laser room to use the simulation equipment, and they were all much more happy, and since then they've been doing these procedures and being much more confident. we plan to run this again. So I think that's also the important thing, is to not just do something once, but to repeat it. So when we repeat it, it'll not necessarily just be for new starts, but also if, again, trainees haven't had the opportunity to do something for a while and they're feeling rusty, I think it's quite important to reinforce what they've been learning.
That's really, really interesting. And even though that's on the college website, I personally hadn't even heard of that. So after this recording, we'll definitely make sure to put a link to those eyes in the show notes, so that hopefully training program directors across the country can see that link and hopefully buy those for their own trainees. By any chance, have you taken any videos or photos of your experience to share with other trainees?
So we have some photos of the simulation, of the laser PIs.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because whenever I've gone on YouTube to try and type in, you know, tutorial on how to do YAG-PI just to show somebody else how to do it, I'm always finding that there's never really a great resource on how to look up these things. So maybe with your simulated eyes, you could make that for us.
We're also hoping to make use of the simulated ocular surgery website run by John Ferris and Link. There's a college channel on that. And there's increasingly videos of the resources and how-to guides. And so Jennifer, in time, is planning to put some videos on there to share the resources. One of the other things I feel is very important is it's not a competition. You know, simulation is for everybody's benefit, and we should be showing and sharing resources. And it's encouraging to me to hear about the collaborations with UKISKers, or with industry involvement, or even the independent treatment centres. Any way we can get our trainees more exposure will make them more competent and therefore more confident.
You know, one of the things that I've picked up on is, David, is that you've talked about really a cultural shift in an attitude towards simulation. And you've talked about, you know, the patient being really the one who suffers ultimately as a result of, you know, trainees not using simulation. Yeah, and as a result of COVID, we've seen a massive increase in the interest and also the usage of simulation, partly because actual surgical experience just isn't available. Do you think this will sustain itself after the pandemic, once we hopefully go back to normal and theatres and theatre opportunity returns?
Well, I would hope so, but I think there's two strands. There's the new trainee who needs to be shown things for the first time at induction, how to fire a laser, how to do a lateral canthotomy safely, the stages of cataract surgery, which the IC does really well, which they can then move on to practicing in the model eyes, and then safely do what they're competent to do in real life. But I think we have to remember, as medics, it's a lifetime of learning, and there will be other skills which we all need to do in the future, which we don't even know exist yet. So, for example, even as consultants, we should be identifying a new technique, reading about it, researching it on iTube, practicing it in the dry lab before we try it on a patient, and that will have much safer outcomes. One of the things I often quote to people is, we now live in the world of injectable lenses, so nobody has any regular experience of putting in three-piece lenses. And when do you put in three-piece lenses? When you've a complication. So we have a situation which is predictable, difficult, and used infrequently. So the time to learn to put in a three-piece lens is not after you've done your first ever anterior vitrectomy and the patient is awake and wondering why the operation is taking so long. The time to learn that is in the dry lab beforehand, and industry are very happy to run such training facilities for you. Why this is relevant to us in Glasgow is because we believe very strongly that surgical logbooks only show what you've done, not necessarily what you need. And through surveying our trainees, we've identified gaps with three-piece lens insertion, sulcus lens calculations, capsule tension rings, Mulligan rings, and then we've been able to put on training sessions to upskill everyone so they are able to use the adjuncts in a safe and timely manner with confidence because they're competent. And that is the big punchline here. Learn the skill before you need to use it.
That's really interesting. And with what you're saying, I think it would be nice to see a cultural shift almost towards industry promoting simulation. For example, if a new stent or MIGS device comes out or is available, those manufacturers of devices hopefully should have the insight to say, okay, you know what, guys, we're going to come and see you, and we're going to bring some microscopes, and we're going to bring some model eyes, and we're going to let you guys practice. I think that sounds really sensible. What do you think?
Increasingly, they do. And a lot of the meetings pre-COVID would have skills transfer sessions at them. And I know our college were trying to increase their exposure to that at our annual congress. But I know Yakiskers have a dry lab session at their annual meeting. And I know that they're trying to look into remote simulation training. So another part of my role as simulation lead will be trying to make people aware of what resources are available in their areas and out with their areas to allow people to engage with them.
So as a consultant and a trainer yourself, how much emphasis do you place on simulation yourself? For example, what is your expectation of a trainee, a junior trainee that you're training for their use of simulation prior to them performing surgery on a real patient?
So one of the reasons I'm so interested in simulation, which I would say is safe training, is because when I got my consultant job 8 years ago, it was a brand new job. And as part of that, I had to set up a brand new theatre, and I was given brand new nurses, and then I was given the first year trainees. And that's quite an intimidating environment, because you suddenly realise you're the only one in the room who knows how these things work. So how do you bring that first year trainee safely to surgical competence? Now, we know there's some mandatory things they need to do anyway, like module A and B in the IC, attending the microsurgical skills course. But through that awareness and that engagement, we are able to demonstrate skills in the dry lab, supervise them on the IC, so we're both speaking the same language, and therefore, whenever they're doing anything on a patient, they're doing what they're competent to do. And then with a modular approach, you can build that up. But it's not, that's just for the basics. We also need to think about how do we plan for the complex and the complication. And that's ultimately where my anterior vitrectomy fire drill came from. Simulating a situation which is predictable, but complex and uncommon, to make sure that we get the best out of a bad situation. And so I took those new theatre staff and the new trainee and asked them, let's pretend the capsule ruptured. What do we do? Where do we find this equipment? How do we set it up? And ultimately that led to the recommendation of the AntFit kit, where you would keep a bag which had the anterior vitrector, the triamcinolone, the myocol and the suture handy. So as Jennifer said earlier, rather than a panic, you just say very politely, could you open the drawer and open the kit? Everything's there. There's no panic. And you get on with dealing with the case. But you also need industry to come in and teach the nurses how to set up for the anterior vitrector. Make sure you've got your laminated cheat sheets and make sure that you're all good to go. And that is the basis for any fire drill. And so I think it's important for the new trainee in particular, you want to test them, but you don't want to throw them over the edge, because you'll cause more damage to them by putting them out of their depth. So it's better that they do small things safely and recurrently, and then build up their confidence doing what they can do. And then eventually they get to put it together. And just as an aside, that's one of the reasons why I use a silicon tip IA for my trainees. And in the past 3 or 4 years, not one of them has burst a capsule doing IA, because we're using equipment which is safer for them, because the margin of errors are slightly bigger.
I would possibly also want to pick up a few things that you've said as a trainee, David, that I think are really, really important for the trainees. So the first thing is about the simulation, and I think it's relatively common for people to be told, go do the IC, work on it and come back when you've done it. And I think actually you can get a lot more out of simulation if you are supervised, like you said, with simulation. Because sometimes I will come across trainees who are struggling with something on the IC, and it's very easy for us to correct and to give them advice, which is something you would do when you were supervising them in theatre. Whereas if they're struggling alone in the IC, they're wasting a lot of their time and they're not getting what they should out of it. And then the second thing is about using simulation to teach people to do something, so that by the time they do come to do it, in a real eye, in a real patient, they are comfortable and they are much happier. And I think that is important for not just patient safety, but also for the happiness and for the sort of the well-being of trainees as well, because I think you will have less stress if you're doing something in a supportive environment and you feel you're ready to do it. And I think also if a trainee has a complication, it's a big deal. Unless, you know, trainees feel very bad whenever something happens that they can't avoid with a patient when they have a complication. And I remember myself as an ST1 trainee, when you have a complication at that stage, you know it's not because it's inevitable. You know it's because you're the trainee, and if the consultant was operating, that may well not have happened. So if you can minimise that, particularly at the beginning, I think that leads to happier trainees as well.
That's a really, really good point. And I do especially agree with you with regards to what you were saying about, you know, supervision of the IC modules. Having recently supervised one of our junior trainees on module D on the IC, I can confirm that it's actually extremely difficult. And we did spend quite a bit of time working on that together. And I suppose this is a good opportunity just to remind all the listeners that on the 18th of February, on the evening, John Ferris is chairing a webinar about remote supervision for simulated surgery. So make sure you tune into that. And it's actually free now, which is really, really good.
It's interesting that you mention Module D is extremely complex, because I've heard that criticism before. Now, I'd like to change tact a little and remind you that all pilots, whether training or trained, have to spend a certain period of time on a simulator to keep their skills up. And we know a friend who lives nearby who's actually a flight controller. And I was asking him what sort of simulation they do. And he said that for some of their simulation, they make the skies around the airport 120% capacity, because they want to push them into situations which makes them be very careful so there's not a catastrophe. And I think of the IC simulator like that for seniors. So I'm fortunate that I'm ambidextrous, but I will do Rexuses with my wrong hand. I will try to chop with my wrong hand. I will use the simulator to make a Rexus run out and recover it. I put in an intraocular lens deliberately upside down and tried to flip it. We can do things with a simulator which pushes us, which allows us therefore with a patient to be much safer, because there's no margins of error on a simulator which is going to cause real damage. So we can use our Module D, which may be very frustrating at times, but actually we can use the principles and the techniques to make us more dexterous and make us better bimanual surgeons. And Jennifer may wish to talk about one of the projects we've recently done demonstrating that.
One of the things that we were very aware of is that cataract surgery is something which is bimanual, it's very delicate, and a lot of what we do with the simulation, particularly with the IC, is training of what tends to be your dominant hand. We've seen previous papers which demonstrate that if you train your non-dominant hand, funnily enough, that your non-dominant hand will become more dexterous. But the issue is, how is that clinically relevant and how can you improve your cataract surgery? And so we looked at training of the non-dominant hand, as David said, doing capsular rexus and things with your non-dominant hand. And we actually found that it could improve your bimanual function. So there's lots of imaginative ways that you can use the IC and you can simulate, both to make it interesting and enjoyable so that you continue to do it, but also to improve your actual cataract surgery.
That's really interesting, and maybe an argument for encouraging all trainees to do the vitreoretinal modules on the IC as well, which force people to use their non-dominant hand as well. You know, I'm going to be devil's advocate slightly, and you know, this question doesn't in any way represent my own belief, but the IC surgical simulator costs over £100,000. You know, is this really a cost-effective way of training the next generation of surgeons?
That's actually a really good question. And if you look in the literature, there's quite a number of papers that look at the cost of the IC and they look at the cost of having a surgical complication. And the cost of a surgical complication is, David can tell us because he's done some work on this, is mitigated, or the cost of the IC effectively is mitigated if you take into consideration the cost of a surgical complication. And I don't necessarily think that each individual hospital needs an IC, but I think each trainee needs easy-ish access to IC simulation.
Yeah, I mean, John Ferris's paper showed quite clearly that the first and second year trainees who'd been exposed to IC cataract training before doing real surgery had less complications. And that demonstrated that that form of simulation was not only cost effective, but also patient saving, which is really the cost we talked about previously. So yes, IC is a captive market. It's really the only one we have, and therefore their price, I think, is quite high. But the reality is we're back to talking about what is the cost of not knowing what you're doing inside the eye, and it's absolutely massive. And we don't talk about those things. So again, one of the things I would like to develop through the National Simulation Lead role is providing more evidence, looking at complication rates and trying to work out how much a complication actually costs. Because if we're going to have a discussion about cost, it needs to be in that context of what you're trying to avoid. And in terms of getting value for money, we know that module A and B is mandatory prior to intraocular surgery. Maybe module C needs to become mandatory by a certain time point. Maybe for the seniors, doing some of the modules could count for CPD, both in supervision and to show demonstration of their surgical skills. So all these things in the future would allow us to make better use of the IC. Because as Jennifer said, when you have these resources, you want to make best use of them. And I think it's important through that culture of learning and always improving to make use of what you've got. As she also said, supervision plays a huge role. It's possible to learn to do things incorrectly, and that's a waste of everybody's time. So it's better to have some direction and then do it safely. And I'm encouraged to see that, for example, the module D now has capsule tension rings, because I think it's interesting. Again, we surveyed in Glasgow how many of the senior trainees had not used capsule tension rings, and yet within a year we're going to become consultants. And you can see it as a race to the bottom or regression to the mean, that if you see a case with a wobbly lens or a suboptimal zonule, but you've never put in a CTR, you're not likely to put in a CTR. Therefore, there's more likely to have complexity and more likely to have an avoidable complication. So if you use those more complex modules to practice it and then backed it up by using it in the model simulation eye, then hopefully, again, you'd be competent and you'd be able to do the necessary adjunct with confidence.
David, worst case scenario, posterior capsular rupture, what's the actual cost?
So I would say that's not the worst case. The worst case is when you break the capsule, you massively increase your risk of cystoid macular edema, massively increase your risk of retinal detachment and endophthalmitis. So what you do at the point of acknowledging the capsule has split is going to have a massive legacy impact for that patient. So once you open the anterior vitrectomy bag, that's about £180 spent instantly. So if you hadn't used an adjunct up at the start, you've definitely spent that money now. In Glasgow, it says on the form, every outpatient appointment costs £135. And between my paper and John Ferris's paper, if you can leave the eye phakic, or if you need to leave it aphakic, you could be looking at £2,000 of direct medical costs. But you've no idea in terms of additional refractions, about time off work, about the patient and their family issues. There's so many more ways we can tease this out. The data from the States would suggest that if you have a case of CMO, you double the cost of the operation. But really, nobody knows. And we are deluded with our budgets because we've got theatre budgets and we've outpatient budgets. But it all comes from the one place and it all impacts on the one patient. So I think the more we think about the costs, the more we're going to realise We can't afford not to know what we're doing. And that's where simulation or better teaching and training will take up that slack.
I completely agree. And I think it's actually really impossible to quantify the physical and numerical cost to a patient, for example, if they have endophthalmitis, if they have a retinal detachment. How can you put a number on the emotional and physical distress that causes a patient potentially for the rest of their lives, which could, not always, but could have been avoided with additional simulation training?
And the cost to the trainee and the trainer of the complaint, of the ombudsman report, of the court case. You know, these are all things we don't like to talk about. But there's huge costs, there's legacy costs of surgical complications. And we need to be aware of that and say, what is avoidable? And fundamentally, if we have a complex patient and we chat before the operation, that's what consent is. If we're having a chat after the operation, that's what a complication is. So we need to be aware of those things and spend a little to save a lot, because it's always going to be cheaper to prevent the complication than having to manage it, both in the short and longer term.
And of course, not to miss out, you know, the emotional impact on a trainee of having a complication and their well-being and effect on their confidence for future surgery as well.
It's definitely a sleepless night usually for a trainee if they've had a complication, and I think, you know, at least one sleepless night, hopefully we can avoid those.
So very final question really for both of you is really about your vision for the future of the way we train surgeons, and how do you see the future of simulation affecting the way we train the next generation of ophthalmologists? For example, in the e-portfolio, we currently have to have sign-offs for procedures, and, you know, some of them, for example, temporal artery biopsy, we have to have at least 2 assessments performed on patients by the end of the ST7 training. Do you think there should be additional or supplementary requirements for some of these procedures to, in addition to being performed on patients, to be performed and demonstrated in a simulated environment prior to be performed on a patient?
So I suppose there's 2 kind of aspects of that question there. The first one would be, where do you see simulation going? And I don't see it going anywhere. I think it's going to continue to be a very important part of training. And I think actually perhaps what we've had the opportunity over the last year is to incorporate simulation much more within training, not to replace surgical training. I think you cannot get competent at surgery just by simulation, but you have to do both together. I think it's something where instead of the simulation being separate, I think it should also be part of the relationship between the trainee and the trainer. So they should, instead of just meeting in the theatre and then the trainee goes off to simulate in their downtime, you know, the trainer and the trainee should be together doing the simulation. I think the type of simulation will hopefully expand further. So like we mentioned, there is the cataract surgical simulation, but there's also exciting and innovative ways to do different subspecialty simulation, both high-tech and low-tech. So you can do things very simply, going back to the tomato skins of old. And I think, again, widening variety of simulation is something that will continue. So the e-portfolio has several bits. So within your DOPS, you can do a DOPS where you have a simulation as well as you have a procedure performed on a patient or a procedure performed in a simulated manner. Now, often the simulation don't count for your stages. So obviously you have to get your 2 temporal artery biopsies you mentioned, or glaucoma surgeries. They need to be on patients rather than on simulation. But I do think it's important to include simulation as a valid way of developing surgical skills. I don't necessarily think you need to be assessed in simulation, but it is a useful way to record it, and something that potentially should be considered in the future.
I would endorse everything Jennifer just said. I think if we step back from this, coronavirus has disrupted medical education irreversibly, and simulation has filled some of the gaps in training. But simulation should have been central regardless of COVID, because what we're actually talking about is removing the patient from the training process to make sure you're competent and confident before you do something surgically. And that will forever be the case, both for the trainee and for the trainer at all points in their career as they either learn a new technique or refine their skills. So I think we have a unique opportunity to enshrine simulation for safer surgery as job plans come back online and people have now recognised the benefits of keeping their skills up. And as Jennifer said, there's lots of different ways to do that. We wish to, and one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is to share awareness of resources, point people in the right direction, and hopefully make their training a safer experience for them, their trainer, but most importantly, the patient. So I remember in how things used to be, and in 2005, when I started my ophthalmology training, I remember that it was very much see one, do one, teach one. And there wasn't the availability of simulated eyes. And so I was attending a diabetic laser clinic, and the registrar with me had done the vast majority of the PRP and left a small segment for me to do. And I had never fired a laser before. And the patient turned to me and said, "Have you ever done this before?" And I had a choice. I could lie and say, "Oh yeah, I've done loads," or say, "No, I have never done this before." To which the patient said, "Well, then you're not learning to play in my eye, because I only have two eyes." And that's always stuck with me, that the patient's view on their interaction with medicine may be very different from our view as trainers and trainees. And if that was your relative, you would actually agree. Any procedure should be done by someone who is competent. And so how do you get competence? You learn about the procedure, you practice it, and then you're good to go. And I think subsequently we got, you used to be able to use a little 35mm slides, which you would put up on a slide projector, and you could fire a laser at those. And through practicing that, then I was able to say to the next patient, "Yes, I've done this procedure before." And so I had more confidence in my ability of being able to deliver what I had to do. And so you can multiply that for any procedure, be it basic phaco steps or complex corneal transplants or glaucoma surgery. We are very blessed to have the range of resources available to us, and we need to engage with them and make use of them.
Great. Well, Jennifer, David, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been really enjoyable.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.